I'm going to advise him to be patient, to be in good condition in front of the judge, to let the judge know the truth about this case.
Yusuf's trial is held in the Chrome Jail in the swamps outside Miami. ICE has flown in a team of four lawyers to try the case. Yusuf's lawyer, Charles Cook, has agreed to take the case for free. No cameras are allowed inside.
We are currently in the second day of the trial. We just finished the testimony of the government's first witness, both his cross-examination and his direct examination. What's at stake is what young Muslim men in America can do and act like in America today. The reality here is, if you're a Muslim in America, you can't think like everybody else. You can't think like your colleagues. I have another client that we went to lunch with a few weeks ago who's about the same age as Yusuf. And I was telling him about Yusuf's case, and it was very interesting what he said. He had very little sympathy for Yusuf. He said, what is he thinking in America as a Muslim man? You can't go surfing on the internet and look at sites. You can't hang around with other people that are Muslims and talk about Islam. And I frankly find that sad.
David Cole is a law professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert in constitutional and First Amendment rights. He says that the targeting of immigrants in America is nothing new.
Historically, whenever the United States has faced a security threat, it has responded by targeting immigrants with its most restrictive measures. And I think that's partly because it's easy to do so. You know, it's one thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat. You've got to sacrifice some of your liberties and rights in order to protect the country. But it's another thing to say to American people, we face a greater security threat, but we're going to give you more security by sacrificing somebody else's rights, namely foreign nationals, immigrants, people who have no voice in the political process. We did it in 1919 after a series of terrorist bombs. We went out and rounded up thousands of foreign nationals on pretextual charges, charges of guilt by association. Not one of them was ever found to have been involved in any of the bombings. During World War II, we rounded up thousands and thousands of Japanese immigrants. This kind of anti-immigrant targeting has been a constant feature in the United States at every point that we've had a security crisis. When you want to take action before somebody has actually done anything wrong, well, the criminal law doesn't really allow you to do that generally. Criminal law requires you to have some proof that an individual has either committed a terrorist act or has conspired to commit a terrorist act or has attempted to commit a terrorist act. It requires that you put the evidence on the table, that you give a person a fair trial. But if you use immigration law, you can find all sorts of pretextual charges to use against people. The government employs secret evidence often in immigration procedures. The same sort of fair trial rights don't necessarily apply. The Supreme Court has said that it's permissible to selectively single out people for immigration enforcement based on their affiliation with political groups. So the same sets of protections and rights don't exist, makes it easier to use the immigration process.
Dan Vara was the highest-ranking ICE attorney in the state of Florida from 2003 to 2006. He says that after the September 11th attacks, he began working closely with the FBI. His prosecutions became a model for using immigration courts as an arm of counterterrorism across the country.
2-3 days after 9/11, people like myself got the word from Washington that some of those obstacles that we had to doing some of the cases that we had been preparing for years were no longer there. And we were allowed to move forward and identify people for charges to be taken into detention and to be prosecuted, again, not criminally, but for the purpose of removing them from the United States. In Florida, once we began our work with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and even its precursor, just the FBI and other loosely associated groups, our involvement was day-to-day. We shared, at the height of my prosecution experience, FBI would feed me information every day.
Vara is proud of his work with the FBI and defends the tactic of seeking the deportation of residents against whom no criminal charges can be proven.
Many people get prosecuted and get acquitted, and they're guilty. When you sit at the table with other prosecutors from other branches of the U.S. government and agents from all these agencies, and you're reviewing evidence, I mean, the goal is to find the way to deal with the threat. And if the only thing you have is tax fraud, if the only thing you have is an immigration violation, then, frankly, that's what you use. An immigration charge is administrative in nature. The burden of proof is less than they are in a criminal trial. So even though you got acquitted in a criminal trial, the reality is that the government could still meet its burden at clear and convincing evidence. There are so many people that put their fingers in every single terrorism case that I would tell you unequivocally that mistakes are not made.
In terms of identifying actual terrorists, the government has been very ineffective. So, for example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the government locked up, mostly using immigration powers, over 5,000 foreign nationals, almost all Arab and Muslim, in anti-terrorism preventive detention measures. Of those 5,000, not one stands convicted today of any kind of terrorist offense. So the government's record there is 0 for 5,000.
They don't have the evidence in these cases, and that's what they see as the beauty of immigration court, is heck, you don't need evidence. You just need a judge who's willing to look at all the garbage evidence and make a conclusory statement that I think you've met the burden of proof. Thank you very much. Have a nice life. Arguably, anything is the proper use of the immigration laws. Congress has designed it to be in many ways like the tax laws that cut Al Capone. Well, if we can't get them on the criminal charges where we have to meet this incredibly high burden of proof, we'll just deport somebody on an incredibly vague immigration statute. These immigration courts are part of the Department of Justice. They are in the executive. This is not a judicial branch. This is not an independent judiciary. This judge was appointed by a previous attorney general. He works for the attorney general. These FBI agents work for, oddly enough, the same attorney general. The folks that are prosecuting this case at Homeland Security are also in the executive branch. The reality is you have the executive branch being both the prosecutor, judge, and jury in this case. We should all be concerned about that. We should be concerned that there is a complete lack of judicial independence here. Why would an immigration judge, whose boss is the one, presumably, that wants to prosecute and deport this man, say, I'm sorry, boss, you're wrong? Boy, it would take a judge with a great deal of courage to do that.
Many people focus on the Bush administration and particularly on 9/11 and the reaction to 9/11 and on, for example, the Patriot Act. But what you miss when you focus in that way is that this is a broader problem.
Now we're in the middle of the Obama administration. Attorney General Holder has approved this. Trust me, if he hadn't approved it, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So clearly the Obama administration is continuing the same enforcement mentality that first Clinton and then the Bush administration followed in immigration.
There's involvement at the highest levels. The Secretary of Homeland Security, I would be very surprised if that person was not Janet Napolitano was not involved in this case. I would be very surprised that if that was the case. Not only because it's a terrorist case, but because of the publicity that it's getting.
A local Islamic group is speaking out about immigration officials' decision to detain Yusuf Megahed.
Having a fair trial and the jury finding not guilty, it seems like a slap in the
face. Their backup plan was to punish them in immigration.
Yusuf was arrested for one reason and one reason only, and that's because he looked Muslim.
With Yusuf's trial already underway, protests by community, religious, and civil rights groups continue to grow. In an unusual move, four of the jurors from his criminal trial, including foreman Gary Meringer, begin speaking out on Yusuf's behalf.
This just doesn't seem right.
There are things under the law that were put into effect after 9/11 that allows the government to simply say, we think you're a terrorist, and therefore you will be detained until you have your day in court, and there's no judicial review of that determination. It's just a unilateral determination made by immigration officials.
We didn't know whether Yusuf should be deported or given full citizenship and allowed to finish engineering school. What we did know a lot about was the case we saw in federal court, and based on that case, he was not guilty of anything, whether it's beyond a reasonable doubt or by a preponderance of the evidence, as might be required in immigration court, or by any measure, that we saw, this kid has, there was no evidence that he had done anything wrong. It's like telling the government, if that's all you got, let him go.
I've been doing criminal defense work for 15 years, and I've never heard of jurors going to the media and saying how outraged they are about what the government is doing to somebody who they just stood in judgment of. It's amazing that they would do that. But I think it says something even more about the disconnect between our government policies and what the people who live in this country want.
If I do talk to somebody about this case, what positive can come about it for me? Not forget about Youssef for a minute. Is there anything good that can happen? And the answer is no. But this is what I need to be doing. I would really like to think at the end of the day I did everything possible I could to get him a fair shake.
I was a history major. And during the pre-American Revolution, what jurors were doing and the verdicts that they were turning down and offenses that were being prosecuted by then the British government was the same sort of thing. It was, we're not going to enforce these laws are wrong, what you're doing is wrong. And that's what these jurors are saying, what you're doing is wrong. You know, the law may allow you to do this, but it's wrong.
What do you think is going to happen at this trial?
Well, based on the evidence that I know of, it ought to be a very short finding of not guilty, but based on what I've heard about the immigration courts, the immigration judges, the influence of the government, the fact they can put on evidence and not even have to show it to the defense, what I think's going to happen is he's going to be found guilty as some sort of terrorist, aider and abettor, whatever, and sent back. Yeah, it's funny, sent back, but sent to Egypt, where he hasn't lived since he was, I think, 11 years old.
At first I was shocked because I knew the family very well, and I knew the Mujahid family, I knew their son, I knew how good he was, and I have a son. So I was scared. I told him, you know what, I don't feel, you know, comfortable for you. What if they did the same thing to you? So it made me feel unsafe. It made me feel scared for my kids. But I felt like I can't let the fear take over me. And I start thinking, right, you know, we have rights. We're American citizens. That we should fight this. It shouldn't take this route because this is wrong. And if we don't fight now, everybody else are scared, afraid, and they're going to hide away from it. So we thought we could fight it together. And I felt, you know, we can do it. If we as a community work together, we can do it. Give me a kind of, you know, strength to stand up and fight. And the more you learn about your rights, you have to stand up for your rights. We had a privilege to fight for our rights and speak our minds and have the freedom to practice our religion. Not because I'm wearing a headscarf, that means I'm a suspect. Not because I'm a Muslim, I'm a suspect. And maybe, you know, with all of us tonight, you know, are united as a community, Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody else, work together to solve this problem. No profiling whatsoever. We will be all safe, because that will be justice.
Yusuf Agat, his family, his mother and his father and his oldest brother naturalized, but they're having mixed feelings because their son is still being held by immigration authorities. Please make dua for the family. Keep tab on the case and support in any way you can.
When anyone in our community or even in a minority community sees this case, especially because this family is immigrants, they see themselves and they see what could happen to them. And I think they're concerned now more than ever, especially everything that's been happening in our community with this case or nationwide. But the main point here is that we have to be aware as Americans, all Americans.
1 week into the trial, just as the defense is about to present its case, the judge makes an unexpected announcement.
The immigration judge terminated removal proceedings. He did the right thing. When the judge walked into the courtroom today, and the first thing he said was, we're going to go over the exhibits in the case. I knew at that point we had won. Because otherwise he never would have talked about the exhibits before I had presented a case. As soon as I realized that, I turned over to Youssef, and I said, I put my hand on his leg, and I said, you won. I don't think he understood me. He looked at me, and he didn't understand, and Dustin, my co-counsel, leaned in and said, you won the case. And then his big old grin, you should smile now, and a big old grin came on his face. He now understands what a great victory this is, frankly, for justice in America. The government presented a case today, and the last 4 days, it was junk. It was all about junk. And as a result, the judge finally realized what it was and dismissed it. This is the second time in my 20-year career that a judge has dismissed charges against somebody and terminated proceedings based upon the government's lack of evidence. So this is a very unique happening for me, and really for any immigration lawyer.
Outside the Chrome Jail, supporters and press wait until sundown for Youssef's release.
I'm very happy for this, and I'm looking forward to go back to university.
I'm feeling so happy for return of my son to spend the Ramadan with us. It is the first night of Ramadan. We feel so happy by having my son to our house again. And I want to send a message for the government that this family, family of Mujahid, came to this country to live in peace and work and take their degrees. Let us finish this thing. Please let us, Mujahid, the family, live here in peace.
I think it's all over now. I'm happy.
Youssef is one of the very few who beat their charges in both criminal and immigration court. Despite no charges ever being filed against him, Rabia Haddad was deported to Lebanon in 2003. After being found innocent of all charges, Sami Hammoudi was held by ICE and then finally deported to Palestine. He now teaches political science at Birzeit University. They both say that the America that they left is nothing like the country they were once proud to call home.
When people ask me about living in the U.S., this is before September 11th, as compared to Lebanon or other parts of the world, I would always make the comment that everything else aside, it's still a country of law, where everybody is equal under the law.
I felt happy in the United States because I felt for the first time that I am free to think the way I want to think, to write the way I want to write, to go wherever I want to go. It's the opposite, 100%. I did not expect what happened after September 11th.
To this day, the government can walk into anybody's home, into any company, any firm in the U.S., freeze their accounts, confiscate all their documents on the basis of doubt. All they have to do is to say, we suspect you of terrorist activity.
In the United States, there is no justice. This is what I believe in, and this is what I teach my students. I don't believe that now inside the United States, anyone can say anything he wants. No. The American Muslims and Arabs are not exercising their full rights as other Americans. They cannot, because they will be punished. And the government has many ways to punish people if they want to. And one time, Ashcroft said, if someone spit in the street, we can try him. We can make laws to try him and put him in jail, if we want.
Civil liberties, human rights, the Bill of Rights are all things of the past. This whole matter of democracy and liberty and the rule of law, and it's just a myth now. It's just a myth. Any Muslim or any Arab living in the U.S. and hearing me say this will not think twice about it. They know it, they feel it, they're living it. But I hope that other U.S. citizens don't end up on the wrong side of the fence to find out how bad this USA Patriot Act really is.
The mentality that will harass the Muslims and Arabs, the institutions that will harass Muslims, will harass others.
Measures first introduced against immigrants inevitably get extended and applied to U.S. citizens. So over time, it's all of our rights that are at stake. So the first measures that that criminalized speech or that penalized political speech were targeted at immigrants, but ultimately became part of our criminal laws during World War I. The first measures that imposed essentially guilt by association were introduced in the immigration law in the early 1900s, but were extended to American citizens during the McCarthy era, and thousands of Americans were affected by that guilt by association. The first sort of ethnic-based targeting enforcement was against foreign nationals from countries whose ethnicity we didn't like. During World War II, that was extended, and we ended up locking up not just Japanese immigrants, but American citizens of Japanese descent. So whether it be, you know, racial discrimination or penalizing speech or guilt by association, the measures are introduced against immigrants initially, but eventually get extended to U.S. citizens.
It's created fear amongst the Muslim community, and a lot of people have become so concerned about stepping up to the plate and being an Americans. I mean, being American means that you have to stand up for your rights, that you speak your mind, you have freedom of worship, freedom of speech. Well, none of this has really flourished in our community after 9/11. Most people are scared to come up and speak their mind simply because they've seen what happens to those who spoke.
Controlling the community is controlling their minds, controlling their feelings. They will all the time be watchful, not to say things they like to say. They will say things that the government would like to hear. Not to do anything that they show that they are full citizen who exercise their full rights.
I think a lot of people are just very scared. Like, they wouldn't really talk about things, or they would try to, like, distance themselves. So I think it's more of just trying to get by, trying to live their lives, you know, go to school, get a job, like, just live a normal life and not really so much involvement outside of that.
Back in Tampa, the Mujahid family sit down to celebrate the beginning of Ramadan, their first meal together since Yusuf's second arrest.
I didn't imagine that we are going to sit together with Yusuf in the first day of Ramadan. Welcome back, Yusuf.
I'm relieved. I'm happy that I'm out of this immigration jail. I was kind of expecting it that I be released, but not on a specific date, because the government did not have a case. Like, they were just holding me up for the heck of it. The government is profiling people, they're targeting people just based on their background, not of any crimes they have done. In my case, of my Muslim background, they were trying to say I'm a terrorist, or that I have to be deported on terrorism grounds. They just want you to sign requesting deportation and leave instead of staying and fighting your case.
We asked Yusuf what he will do now that he has won. Who does he want to be held accountable for his years in prison? Will he continue to speak out on behalf of others who are facing similar charges? His father, Samir, interrupts before Yusuf can answer.
Don't ask him many questions, because the government still now can make an appeal against him.
Do you think they will appeal, or do you think...
I didn't know. They have the right to do anything.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Through these last few episodes, we've been talking about freedom of women as prescribed as in Islam. And so far, we've touched upon the topic of freedom of working outside of the home for women and also freedom of ownership and financial independence, which are really interesting topics to even be aware that they exist in Islam. Next time someone says, oh, Islam is all about oppressing women, you know, just... Yep, reality check. So, Sister Salma, today we're going to continue with these discussions, and I am excited to find out more about what other freedoms does Islam allow for female citizens of the world?
What other freedom that is a privilege to women and to show that she has the right to make her own decisions is the freedom in marriage. But with this freedom in marriage, it doesn't let you go out of hand as well in Islam. Mm-hmm. And when you see it getting out of hand, there are some things that don't go, you know, properly.
Yes, of course.
You know, and you see that actually openly in the Western world, mm-hmm. it happens. You know, when a woman, when a girl especially decides her own life partner without the consent of her father mm-hmm. or her grandfather, mm-hmm. then... you know, it probably backfires on her because she's not made the right decision due to lack of experience that the father has, you see. So it's very important. She can choose. She has all the right to choose, like before getting married, unlike, again, the Arab Jahiliyyah and the days before the advent of Islam. This, you know, the sublime religion that is, gives a way of life. Women were not allowed to. They were like property. They were all sold off. Or even after the advent of Islam, if you go and see, you know, when everything returned back again slowly by slowly due to a lot of misguidance and wrong leaders and, you know, evil leaders.
Yeah. From the path,
so
yeah.
Again, like, and other, you know, religions. The teachings of other religions like Hinduism, Buddhism, women were taken as a commodity, really. They were like not allowed to choose their own life partner. And it infiltrated a little in Islam as well. Mm. All the days, if you go and see when we ask our grandparents that, did you have the right to choose? No. We just knew that, you know, that we had to get married to so-and-so.
Super arranged marriage.
Super arranged. It's really sad,
that,
especially when a woman who has all the, you know, right to choose and to like or dislike, suddenly she finds somebody whom she doesn't want to talk to even.
Exactly.
Or somebody she doesn't prefer looking
at. It's heartbreaking.
It's very heartbreaking.
And it's so interesting, Sister Salma, because even Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, about whom Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has said that there is no one suitable from her, from Adam Nabi Allah till Nabi Isa, supposedly, among all the prophets that ever came and went, all the good people, no one is more suitable for her than Ali. Even in this case, Rasulullah asked her first. Yeah. Ali asked your hand for marriage. Are you cool with that? Are you good with that? Would you like to accept? And when we do the exact opposite for our own daughters, and then we have the audacity of saying, oh, it's the Islamic way of life, you know? Yeah. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Islam allows so much privilege that a woman can talk, and many times with the intention of
marriage.
A man can do the same, like, you know, to find out the compatibility between a man and women, if they're the right partners, suitable partners, spouses for each other. So she is like man, completely free in choosing her own partner and her own spouse. And without her consent, you know, this marriage is void, actually.
Wow.
It's void. It's batil.
Wow.
So if she is not happy and she's forced to go into a marriage, then, you know, like I feel that even if the marriage contract takes place, there's a big sinner, and that's the family who has decided and forced for her.
Exactly.
They're sinners.
They've ruined two lives, yes. And probably the lives of the children that are going to be the product of this marriage.
Yes. A whole society, because the smallest unit begins with the children, the family, the first unit of the society. So that's why Islam looks at it so broadly, you know. It wants the woman to choose. Mm. And then there are no excuses left also for a woman to say that, you know, like, I'm very unhappy in this marriage.
Oh, you chose her, honey.
Exactly. Allah wants her to choose, to select, to think about it, to see whether that person is compatible for you or not, and then to move on with your life. And then those offsprings are those leaders, وَجْعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. And that's why that ayat really is beautiful. It goes in a kind of systematic way that if your spouse is a like Qurratul Ayn for you, that, you know, the children will be Muttaqeen for Imam for the
Muttaqeen. That is so beautiful.
Like, Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yun.
Lord, grant us, from our spouse and our children, those who are the light of our eyes, being joy to our hearts.
Exactly.
And only through that can you produce
those
highest
exactly.
children. Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Yes. And that's the only way, like, that's a beautiful thing that Allah has kept, that we can, so, you know, choose our spouses.
Mm.
So, and then we can raise those kind
comes
of offspring that give that satisfaction and that coolness,
exactly,
you know,
absolutely.
Of the heart.
Next time someone attempts to undermine the value of love and emotional compatibility between a young boy and girl who are supposed to get married, they should really refer themselves back to this ayah, that this couple really has to enjoy each other's company. They have to be attracted to each other mentally, physically, emotionally, and their eyes have to light up when their spouse walks into the room so that they can make anything positive out of this marriage, really. Why would we want people to be miserable for the rest of their lives?
Yes, why would Allah choose? You know, it's sometimes it so happens that a spouse or a girl wants to marry someone badly, and she convinces the family, and the family knows this is not good for her, and then she sees in life how, you know, everything goes wrong.
Apart,
she's divorced. She learns the hard way then.
Mm.
And Allah does not want her to learn the hard way. Sometimes she ends up with a child and she has to raise herself. So she struggles so much. And then you see that she can't get married to, sometimes it happens that it's sad that, she, you know, she can't get that partner that she always wanted to in her, like the way if she was a spinster or a virgin. Right?
Mm-mm.
So all this Allah sees to the interest that if you are a virgin, you have to ask permission from your parent, that is your father and your grandfather.
We've touched upon the topic of freedom of working outside of the home for women, and also freedom of ownership and financial independence, which are really interesting topics to even be aware that they exist in Islam.
With this freedom in marriage, it doesn't let you go out of hand as well. In Islam, a girl is on the emotional side more. She makes quickly decisions. She wants, if somebody, you know, just admires her,
sweeps her off her feet.
Yeah, sweeps her off her feet, unfortunately. But she doesn't realize that there's something. And that's why the relationship with the father is very
so
important.
Yes.
That she can realize that how it is. That,
exactly.
You know, to converse, what qualities should you look for.
Mm.
And the father also makes that girl feel appreciated in the right way.
Mm.
That, you know, this is not all about it. Like, you know, like just admiration. No, admiring your quality. qualities that you have, you know, your potentials that you have, appreciating your personality. Mm-hmm. That's very important.
It's
so
very
she
important.
Needs to be appreciated in her personality, exactly. Because all these things are not long-lasting. So she might be swept away by her feet because of her beauty, but that'll not last.
A
man getting tired of everything around him when he sees that those right qualities are not there,
yes,
to make him happy.
Of course.
You know? He needs somebody to talk to, somebody to give companionship,
yeah,
somebody to raise his kids in the proper way, right? Mm. Somebody to not just complain and, you know, always nag around at home.
Yeah,
however absolutely. Beautiful that person might
I know,
be. You
know? I know.
There's so many divorces happening because of that.
Exactly.
So the right decision, the right way, and the woman is also allowed to do that.
Mm.
And sometimes, ironically, it happens that a girl always is refused by her parents. And then she sees somebody so good in all, you know, ways. And then, you know, like the fiqhi point of view, she can actually be allowed to get married.
When, exactly.
When all the qualities are there. But
the parents are still.
Yeah, yeah. Still, the parents are just, you know. Maybe.
There could be so many reasons. She could be the only daughter.
Yeah.
She could be their only child.
Possessiveness.
Possessiveness.
You know, or wanting more of wealth and position,
yes, exactly.
And fame and from the boy. Instead of taqwa and, you know, good deeds and
akhlaq.
Iman, akhlaq. Mm. And I'm not saying that he should be completely poor and not compatible status. But, you know, all this, if you go and see the lower level, the fathers sometimes don't accept. They say that because so-and-so doesn't have a house. He has to live on rent, you know. But a person can probably afford to live on rent. So-and-so doesn't have a car. He has a motorcycle. But so-and-so at least has a motorcycle.
Exactly.
Would keep you happy.
Mm. Would you rather your daughter be miserable in a mansion or with the man she loves in a rental home?
Exactly. And
right?
The woman herself will realize that that rental home is better than the mansion when you have the love and the companionship.
The respect, the understanding.
Yeah, the respect.
Mm.
So all this, and you know, beautiful point is that when you look for those qualities, and this is like a lesson for the women to where they choose, the qualities that are the real qualities that Allah wants you to grow and to become perfect, then you get everything together. There's a hadith that says, one who looks for beauty would get probably beauty. One who looks for wealth would probably get that wealth and fame and everything. But one who looks for those qualities like Iman and Godhead, then would get both together.
Beautiful.
Yeah, because everything would satisfy her.
Mm.
And it would grow, actually.
Exactly.
The risk is, you know, min haythu la yahtasib.
Yes.
Yughdihu Allahu min fadli. His fazl. You probably don't deserve
favors.
It, but because you were so good to your family, your wealth grows.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Thank you so very much for that interesting discourse, Sister Sanma. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Here, when we're talking about nature, we're talking about respect, we're talking about honor, we're talking about responsibility, accountability, we're talking about amana, we're talking about something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed on this earth for a reason, and we're talking about us representing all of these things in the best way possible. I'm not just talking about, oh, let's plant some trees and let's not waste water, but we're talking about creating a ripple effect in our society where other people around us will also become more responsible and more accountable for what it is that they're doing towards harming and damaging nature. And that kind of accountability and self-awareness is extremely important. Alhamdulillah, we can say that as far as our religion is concerned, it instructs us on a halal haram way, on a wajib haram way, you know, to make sure that we are observant of these things. So if you wrong nature, you are wronging Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That means you're committing a grave sin. And that itself is the best wake-up call that we need to become more responsible and more accountable for what it is that we are doing as far as nature is concerned. I think one of the very, very sad topics that we hear about when it comes to the topic of animals and animals becoming extinct, animals becoming endangered because of human greed, you know, they need a rhino horn for some kind of mixture in a medicine, and they kill the whole rhinoceros, you know, and no, it needs to be the white rhinoceros, or, you know, killing monkeys because of monkey brains supposedly gives someone some kind of power. All these other unfortunate things that some humans do out of greed. The same thing when it comes to nature as well. You know, all these corporate companies, damaging and in destroying the ecosystem because of greed, because they want to produce more and they want to sell more. No honor, no respect for the indigenous tribes, for holy land, for sacred land of these indigenous tribes. No honor and no respect for the villages that live there, for what they are going to be leaving behind as well, you know. And as I said, just look at the statistics of these forests that are disappearing on a daily basis. It's devastating, it really is. And it's all because of us human greed. Every 6 months we want to change our desk and our cupboard and our kitchen, and we want to do this and we want to do that.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
You know, there's supply and demand. You know, we want more, and these companies are giving us what it is that we want. We don't feel that we have that level of accountability and responsibility towards these things. So, you know, it doesn't matter if something has become obsolete or not, as far as furniture is concerned, wooden furniture is concerned, we just get rid of it anyway because we want to change something in our house. You know, and then we read these stories about Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and not even Ahlul Bayt, salamullahi alayhim, even our ulama, even our forefathers, you know, older generations, you know, they would cling on to something and, you know, they'd say, what's wrong with what it is that I have? Why do I need to, you know, get something new if there's nothing wrong with this? Yes, I've had it for 15 years, I've had it for 20 years, but if there's nothing wrong with it, why do I need to change it? That's the problem of consumerism in today's society, that there is some kind of high expectation that you change things even though you don't really need it. And that is contributing in a bad way to the damaging of our nature. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi speaks about this in many, many ways. Most importantly, the destroying or the cutting down of a tree for no purpose. Man qata'a sidratan, if someone cuts down a sidr tree, someone cuts down a lot tree, sawaballah ra'sahu finnar. If someone cuts down a tree, for no reason, of course, for no reason, you know, there's no purpose, no reason, just cutting it down because you feel like it. Doesn't have some kind of purpose. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will cut their head, sawaballah ra'sahu, will cut their head down, will place their head down, will push their head down in hellfire on Judgment Day. لا تقطعوا الثمار فيصب الله عليكم العذاب صبا. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, don't cut down fruit-bearing trees, or else Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will rain upon you his adab, his punishment. Then this interesting hadith, all talking about trees, all talking about forests. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, mimma yazidu fil umr, something that will increase your lifespan. Tarkul adha, not harming, not hurting people. Wa tawqiru shuyukh, respecting your elders. Wa silatur rahim, observing kin between your family members and your relatives. Wa an yuhtaraz an qat'i al ajjar al rabtah illa 'inda al durura, and that you stay away, that you avoid the cutting down of trees unless it is necessary. وَإِصْبَاغُ الْوُضُوءُ وَحِفْضُ الصَّحَّةُ, and continuously remembering to be in the state of wudu, and also making sure that you stay healthy. Continuing on with this, we know that there is a recommendation of planting. This hadith says, أَزْرِعُوا وَأَغْرِسُوا, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, وَاللَّهُ مَا عَمَلَ عَمِلَ النَّاسِ عَمَلًا أَحَلُّ وَلَا أَطْيَبُ مِنْهِ. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, plant trees. And by Allah, there's no deed, there's no act more halal and more pleasant and more good and more better than this. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Hidden Files. When I was a 12-year-old Black American junior high school student in a predominantly white school, I was chosen for an important task due to my reading skills and high diction. Well, the task was to read a eulogy to honor a very important white man who had just died. I, of course, had no idea who this man really was and the suffering he had caused for many. It was only later that I came to know the true John Edgar Hoover, the former head of the FBI and the mind behind COINTELPRO. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, the man known as J. Edgar Hoover had been the first director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he'd headed the organization for almost 50 years. He was instrumental in carrying out a deadly program by the FBI called COINTELPRO, which stood for Counterintelligence Program, and existed from the 1950s until the 1970s. Now, this clandestine program was carried out against American activists and organizations.
COINTELPRO was an FBI operation established in the 50s by J. Edgar Hoover to target African Americans who were fighting for justice and equality. He targeted Dr. King, he targeted Malcolm X, and over 80% of the targets of COINTELPRO were members of the Black Panther Party.
And this is what they did during the next 14 years, from federal agents all the way down to local police. They would spy on civil rights leaders and others, which was, of course, illegal. Then they carried out assassinations, both physical and character assassinations, to stifle movements such as the Black Panther Party. Now, in order to justify these assassinations, the federal agents would actually fabricate evidence, set up crime scenes by staging false flag attacks, incite riots, and engage in many other criminal and inhumane activities. Now, the groups targeted by the FBI were quite diverse, from anti-war activists to Black nationalists, but none, absolutely none, was targeted quite in the same way as the Black Panthers.
J. Edgar Hoover was FBI director for almost 50 years. It is said he had enough information on just about anyone to blackmail them, even presidents of the country. His number one enemy was the Black Panther Party, as he sought to prevent unity in the Black community. As FBI director, Hoover oversaw COINTELPRO and ordered agents to destroy, disrupt, and neutralize the Panthers. In 1969, U.S. domestic intelligence budget was $7.4 billion. There were 295 operations by the FBI against Black groups. 233 of these operations were directed at the Panthers. 28 members of the Panthers were murdered by the FBI that year.
One of the main individuals who was targeted by COINTELPRO was Fred Hampton. Now, Fred was a charismatic young law student of the Chicago branch of the Black Panthers. He was a dedicated revolutionary and orator.
We work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just it's a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people. All powers of people. That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbilly, I hate Indians. So we fight amongst each other.
Well, I'd like to welcome to Hidden Files, Johanna Fernandez.
Johanna Fernandez is Associate Professor of History at Baruch College of the City University of New York and author of The Young Lords, A Radical History. Professor Fernandez is the writer and executive producer of the film Justice on Trial, The Case of Mamia Abu-Jamal.
Thanks so much for being with us here on Hidden Files. Now, there's so much evidence that the actions taken under COINTELPRO were illegal. So can you tell us why no one was ever prosecuted for these crimes?
Well, the COINTELPRO program, or COINTELPRO, is an extra-legal organization of repression developed by the American government. It's like the CIA. The CIA is engaged in all manner of homicidal activity around the world, but it's an extra legal organization. So that's a great question. Essentially, we would need a movement exposing, for example, the atrocity we saw with the assassination of Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969. He was assassinated Latin American dictatorship style in the streets of Chicago, actually in his own bed. And you talked about the relationship between political prisoners, their imprisonment, and sometimes the assassination of black radicals. Well, COINTELPRO sent an agent into the organization, the Black Panther Party, of which